Okay, today is September 3rd, 2014. This is somewhat of a continuation of an interview with Mike Warlam. I am here in my office, and Mike is at his home in Seattle, Washington. This interview is being done specifically for our LGBTQ Oral History Project, and my name is Troy Reeves with the Oral History Program at the UW Mass and Archives. So, Mike, I gave you questions in advance, and you sort of looked through them and gave some initial comments. We're just going to follow the script, so to speak, and then I'll ask follow-up questions if I see fit based on your answers.
Sure.
So I think we'll start chronologically, and it's the growing up question. So it is, how did you feel towards people of the same sex during your preteen and teen years?
Well, I was always drawn to people of my sex, but I can't say exclusively. I mean, I enjoyed a lot of people as much as I could. I was pretty shy, but I had a little encounter when I was about maybe 10 or so. I shouldn't say little because it happened several times. With a real close friend of mine, it was kind of, you know, childhood experimentation. It didn't amount to much. And then I had kind of an ongoing, I wouldn't say relationship, but an ongoing set of encounters with someone when I was in high school. But as I say, I was always attracted to men, but also I was in a lot of denial.
Mm-hmm.
And being raised Catholic, that was a major issue, the denial and the guilt.
Mm-hmm. Mike, was this experimentation at 10, was it akin to the sort of the stereotypical or archetypal plain doctor, you know?
Yeah, it wasn't that precisely, but it was in that realm, yes.
Okay. So this, I think, leads somewhat to one of the specific questions I wanted to ask you, and that was, you know, you, in the previous interview, you talked about sort of being a loner, and some of that you attributed to what you found out later was growing up with dyslexia. You know, they didn't call it that at the time. They didn't know what it was really at the time. But I'm wondering if this attraction towards people, people of the same sex might have helped may not be the right word, but sort of attributed also to sort of your feelings of being a loner or loneliness.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no question about that. I didn't ever identify it as such that way, but yeah, it certainly did. As I look back, I realize that I spent an inordinate amount of time analyzing myself and trying to get in. I never was very successful at it, but I was always sort of trying to be normal. And, I mean, in the terms of those days, and so yeah, it really was a factor. I remember when I was a freshman in high school in Phi Ed, people calling me queer boy, and so they all picked up on it before I really did.
Hmm.
And it was a big factor in my feeling like a loner.
So, Mike, your teenage years were like in the mid to late 50s, mid-50s?
Mid-50s, yeah.
And, you know, you just said that your peers would call you queer boy. I was as curious even before you said that as to, you know, what, if anything, you knew about homosexuality, you know, as a teenager.
I knew nothing. All I knew is that it was something that was a sin worse than murder, and it was something to be denied at all costs. And I was, you know, I mean, I had some awareness of it, but nothing, nothing substantive at all. And I've often thought how different my life would have been if I'd had access to gay pornography, because I would have had some idea of what to do, at least.
Mm-hmm. Or even just sort of access to just what it is. I mean, just sort of...
I mean, it was terribly lonely, because I grew up in a very, very small town, about 2,500 people. And so there was literally nobody to identify with. And we're talking pre-media here. So there was nothing, you know, I didn't see anything or read anything or hear anything to give me any kind of feeling that I wasn't alone.
Mm-hmm. So in high school, did you go out on dates with women or young women?
Yeah, sure.
But was that as much for your loneliness as it was for anything else?
No, it was trying to fit in.
Okay, so keep up appearances.
I mean, you know, it's hard to convey how utterly confusing it all was, because I was in denial. I figured I was going through a phase, and that would go away, and then I would be happily married, working in an office somewhere, and. And so I dated, I was, as I said earlier, I was very shy, so I didn't date a lot. I hated the idea of being rejected, and so it was easier not to go on dates than to ask and risk a chance of being turned down. But I did date some. I went to the prom and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, high school teenage years are tough enough, you know, as it is, when you sort of and add at least in your growing up, you know, your feelings are, as you said, you know, in the Catholic Church are akin to, you know, being a felon. So it had to be a difficult time for you.
I think that we have a great gift, and that we don't know how bad things are when they're bad. Mm. You know, it's when you think later how awful it was. But getting through it was just, I mean, it's what you're presented with, so you just slog onward and get through it. But it was pretty awful. And, you know, add to that the fact that I got no sexual education whatsoever of any kind, and even especially from my parents.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something I wanted to ask. It's not coming to me. You'll see if it comes to me. So now, as you are heading to UW-Madison, and can you remind me? I think you said this in the longer interview, but was UW-Madison your first choice, your only choice?
I had two choices, actually. I could have gone to Eau Claire State College, which is now has a different name, or I could go to the university. And I remember having quite a hard time making that decision. What's interesting to me is that never in the thinking about it, that the idea of a private college, or indeed any other college, crop up. I mean, it just wasn't on the landscape at all. I finally decided on University of Wisconsin because my mother and her twin sister had graduated from there, and also two or three teachers that I was in contact with, whom I admired, had graduated from there. And so that was why I made the decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, Mike. There was no, it sounds like there was no thought not only of private school, but no thought of a school outside of Wisconsin?
Oh, no, not at all. I look back on it and it's kind of awesome. I mean, I can't figure out why none of that entered in, because other people I knew went to private colleges and out of state actually, but it just didn't occur to me.
Mm-hmm. So, Mike, that brings us to UW-Madison. We have a couple of questions here. The one is, or maybe the first is, I already know the answer, but I want to hear it. So at this point, coming to UW-Madison, you're not even out to yourself. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. So once you get to university, what sort of, if any, same-sex experiences do you have?
Nothing until I was a senior. The only sex I had was when I was home in the summertime. This fellow I mentioned earlier from high school and I would get together.
Okay.
And that was pretty vanilla stuff. And then when I was a senior, I had a brief encounter with somebody, which totally freaked me out.
And at that point, so you, did you know of any, you know, now that you were in Madison, did you know of any, you know, gay bars or places where gay
men... Not as an undergraduate, no.
Okay. If you don't mind me asking, you said the experience you had as a senior freaked you out. Why did it do so?
Because this guy picked me up. We were at a party, and he asked me to have a cup of coffee. And so when we got to near his apartment, he said, "Well, you might as well just go upstairs." And then he made a grab for me, and thinking back on it, I know that I was anticipating it at some level and was excited about it. And as soon as he touched me, I I came in my pants. Mm. And that freaked me out to the point where I just got up and left.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't, I mean, talk about a brief encounter. It was about as brief as you could be and included the briefs, actually.
So by the time you're a senior, are you, well, let me ask it this way. So are you in college and undergrad, are you going out on dates with women at that point?
I lived in a rooming house with, there were eight of us. And as far as I can remember, none of us really dated. It was, my parents weren't poor, but they didn't have a lot of extra money to play with, and I was very grateful for their support of me in college. And so I did everything I could not to spend money. And so, like, recreation was things like going to a movie on the weekend, and that was about it. I didn't date as an undergraduate at all.
And Mike, was this part of too, in the interviews that you did where you were asked questions about Professor Gard, you talked about sort of your academic work ethic. I mean, was part of it too that you, school for you was, you know, going to school, getting a degree?
Oh, yeah. That was my parents told me I was not to work because my job was to be a student. And so I took the job very seriously. I missed a whole lot of rich experience at the University of Wisconsin at that time because my nose was buried in books. And yeah, absolutely, I applied myself, and that was the first job. I'm glad you brought that up because I hadn't thought about that factor. But yeah, that's true.
Mike, another thing that you and I talked about before we turned on the recording, but I want to make sure we get on the record, so to speak, is in 1962 on this campus, there was it's now called the Gay Purge. It was a systematic effort to, you know, really rid the campus of primarily gay men. It sounds like from what you and I talked about before the recording was on that you knew nothing of that effort. Is that correct?
No, I never heard about it until you mentioned it. I knew nothing about it at all. I don't doubt that it went on at all. It seemed very typical of the times. And I was trying, when you and I were talking before the interview, you mentioned that it was like the dean of men or dean of students, and I've been trying to think who that was, and I don't even know that.
Mm-hmm. And Mike, I'll do my my best, you know, whether or not we have a follow-up interview to find out a little bit more about it, just so you can know who might the main characters have been.
Yes, I really would like to.
You know, if not, probably not the actual, you know, the students who were dismissed, but at least the administrators who felt it appropriate to try to do something like this.
Yeah, as I say, it does not surprise me in the least. It really is a symptom of what the times were like.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody would have questioned it either. I mean, nobody would have acted as though it was a wrong thing to do.
Right. There wasn't much, if any, civil rights at that time for...
There was none.
For gays and lesbians.
Black Power movement was underway at that time, but the question of gay rights, didn't arise until Stonewall.
Mm-hmm.
It really was not on the radar.
So you spent, you know, off and on 11 years here, I believe, from 1958 to 1969.
Yes.
And you got your undergraduate, you got your bachelor's degree in 62 or 63, I can't remember.
62.
So did you, and I'm sure we said that we asked this in the GARD interview, but did you go directly to graduate school from undergrad?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So what was different about your graduate and undergraduate that, you know, you said you started to try to learn more about gay culture in town? What was it about graduate school or your age or whatever that made you want to do that?
Well, do I know an answer to that? Let me think. One factor was that I had my own apartment. I went to graduate school. And I suppose the first couple of years of graduate school, I don't think I was very aware of where I was sexually.
Mm-hmm.
And then I finally met some people. I finally met some people and started having some encounters and realized that I liked it very much.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall the places where you would meet these people?
One was in my, I belonged to a writing group, and one of them was in the writing group. Another one was a friend of a friend of mine, and I met him, you know, at social occasions, and that was about it, actually.
So again, in your experience, it wasn't you know, gay bars or social places where gays or lesbians might hang out. It sounds like
See, that was at that time. Those venues were very limited.
Mm-hmm.
There was a bar over on University called the 602 Club, and that was that was gay in the front, and straight in the back. The bar part of it was gay, and then in the back there were tables, and all the straight people would go there and drink beer at the tables. And then there was a place called the Velvet Swing, which was partway up toward the Capitol up there. And those were about the only two that I remember even knowing about.
Mm-hmm.
There was no place to go to meet gay people.
So knowing about but you didn't frequent them.
That's right.
Okay. So in my in your initial responses to my to our questions, you said you were about 24 when you had your first live-in lover. So is I mean, that's 1964 if my math is right. So is that when you start to identify?
I think I'm wrong. I think I was wrong when I said 24.
Okay.
It was more like 25 or 6, maybe 26. And, yeah, I was, by that time, I had it together enough so that I could even consider doing something like that. And so, yeah, I was starting to get to know myself a little better by that time. Yeah, I was on faculty already at that point, but yes, that was about when.
Where did you meet this person?
Oh, I did meet him at a gay bar. I met him at the Velvet Swing.
Okay.
And it turned out, as we talked, he was somebody that I had known when I was a little kid, and then he and his family had moved elsewhere, and so I met him again, I had a real unfortunate aberration, which was that during the time I should have been experimenting and exploring sexual activity, all I could was focused on was a full-time long-term relationship. And when I think back, I really wish that I hadn't felt that way, because I think it would have, for me at least, it would have been very important to have quite a bit of experience before I encountered a relationship.
Right. That's not necessarily universal, but I mean, that is something that, you know, both same sex and straight folks, you know, sort of the battle between either as many partners as possible or, you know, long-term love or relationship, whatever you want to call it.
Well, I lost that battle because I was so committed. I mean, this fellow was not ready to settle down and had a whole different relationship idea of what a relationship should be from what I did. And then there was somebody after that, and the same kind of thing happened. I was so dedicated to monogamy and to doing things that couples should do and all that. I must have been a terrible bore for these people.
So, Mike, it's in graduate school when you meet Professor Gard.
Yes, that's right.
And so I'm curious, and I obviously, you know, this is one of the questions I asked you. What, if anything, you think that he knew about your sexuality?
I know that he had strong suspicions about it, because he conveyed those to Ralph Koloff, who was a colleague of mine and also worked for Gard. And Ralph asked me about it, and of course I denied that I was gay. But so I know Gard thought about it. It would have been very hard to miss. I mean, I was going through one of those experimental periods that a lot of people go through, where it's dyeing my hair and, you know, affecting mod dress and all that kind of thing. It would have been very hard for him not to figure something out. But he and I never, I mean, there was never a confrontation or never a discussion of it.
It's difficult for us to figure out how somebody else would think, but Do you have any idea how he might have responded if he knew you were
no,
gay?
I have a very good idea. He was, at the time, he was deeply homophobic. And I'd like to think that as time went by, maybe he got over that. I don't know. But at that time, he made a number of remarks about people that we dealt with and people that we knew about that made it very clear what his feelings were about it. I remember one time for the Rhinelander School of the Arts, we were looking for an artist or a writer in residence, and I had just read Giovanni's Room, and so I suggested, I said, why don't we get James Baldwin? And I said, oh, he's a desperate homosexual. And so, which was very intriguing, because I thought I'd love to know what a desperate homosexual was. But there were a number of things like that made it very clear what his feelings were about it. And I'm pretty well convinced, although with no evidence, that one of the reasons that he didn't choose me to keep me on faculty was that there were a number of factors, but I'm sure that was one of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and from your perspective, how difficult was it to work with? Because I'm sure Professor Gard wasn't the only person you encountered who made comments like that.
No, that was very common at the time. Gay jokes were common. Being anti-gay was the norm. And yeah, it was difficult. It was confusing, and it was kind of stifling. And that I knew that even if I took exception to what was being said, there was nothing that I could say about it.
Right, you'd have no.
No, there was no support base of any kind. There were no positive role models. There was no positive literature about it. There was not. It was terribly benighted.
Mm-hmm. In any of your travels in graduate school, as you were working on community arts, were there any anecdotes you remember, situations you remember where either your sexuality or your closeted sexuality was an issue?
No, really not.
So again, it might be in your case, you were doing the work and trying to do the best you could while working?
Yeah, I also had developed a real talent for not mixing up the two parts of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't make any point of trying to be macho straight, but I didn't identify as gay either.
Okay. When was it, in the notes you told me, and when we've been talking here, 25, 26 is when you had your first sort of live-in lover and became sort of more comfortable with your sexuality. When did your parents or other family members, did you come out to get them, or when did they?
Oh, that was kind of pathetic. I never did. And of course, it's important to understand that whole generation, and even some people in my generation, were accepting only because they never discussed it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they never, the question never arose. And so, even though it was like an elephant in the room, still nobody talked about it. And that my parents were kind of like that. And then finally, when I was about probably mid-30s, Stephen, my current lover, and I had decided to move to Seattle. And so I went home for a little while before we moved, and my mother took me aside and sat me down and said, "Now, I want to know why you're following this man across the country." And I said, I said, "Well, I think you know." And she said, "Oh, don't tell me you're one of those." And she had little hands with little kind of little pork sausage picky fingers. And whenever she would get upset about anything, she would lace her hands together and lace her fingers together and twiddle her thumbs. And I have that image of her sitting there looking at her hands and just being in despair. And she said, "I'm not accepting this. I'm not accepting this at all." And my reaction was, what the heck is going on here? I'm 36, 35 years old or whatever I was. And how pathetic that this should be happening at this time in my life when it was doing nobody any good. It was really, really kind of awful and sad, really sad. And with my dad, the subject never came up. We never discussed it ever.
So then, as you were in your mid-20s and coming out at least yourself, did you have friends who knew and who supported you when you needed support?
I had one friend who was a very, very dear friend of mine. We had been friends in high school, and then he went to River Falls to undergraduate school, and then came to University of Wisconsin, Madison, for graduate school as an art major. Don Reedy, he's an emeritus professor now from the University of Wisconsin, and taught art at the center in Rice Lake for 30 years or so. Anyway, Don, I told Don about it, and he was very supportive and didn't treat it as something strange. He and I used to kid about going out cruising. He'd look for women and I'd look for men, and that was very supportive. But he's about the only one, actually.
So with your colleagues, not we've already talked about Professor Gard, but with your colleagues here, it wasn't a subject that ever.
No, it wasn't. It's hard to convey how really taboo the whole thing was in those days. I mean, in retrospect, talking about it now, it seems kind of ridiculous. But the attitudes were very different.
Is there anything else about your time at Madison that is on your mind?
I don't think so. I can't think of anything else that really comes to mind. I'm looking at my notes here.
Okay. Well, while you're looking at your notes, if something does come up, we'll have some space at the end of this one. The one thing I want to get for sure this time, and maybe we'll save sort of more present-day LGBTQ issues for a follow-up interview, but the thing I want to make sure I get to this time is your meeting Steve and your relationship with Steve. So I wonder if you wouldn't mind talking about that.
Oh, no, not at all. By the time I met Steve, it was 1970. And I was, at that time, I'd left Madison, and I was executive director of the Indiana State Arts Commission. And I was seeing a fellow who was a dancer at Butler University. And of course, I was on my never-ending quest for a long-term relationship. And he was just honest enough to say that he wasn't looking for a long-term relationship. But he kindly introduced me to this fellow who had moved into the rooming house where he lived. And I took one look at him and thought he was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my life. And so he did horoscopes. And so I asked him if he would do my horoscope. And he said yes. And so sometime later he called up and said, I have your horoscope ready, and I'll bring it to your apartment if you like. And I said, oh, sure, that'd be great. So he showed up, and he started telling me my horoscope. And I kept saying, well, gee, that doesn't really seem to apply. I don't think that's what I'm like. And he finally said, you were born in 1942, right? And I said, no, 1940. And without a word, he simply crumpled up his notes and threw them on the floor. And that's all she wrote. It was he.
Did he go back and do one based on your 1940 book?
No. I should ask him for that, actually. No, he didn't. But he stayed with me that night and never went back again, never went home again. That was it. I made my pitch, and for once somebody was receptive. And so we've been together 45 years next month.
Right.
No, 44 years next
month. Right, right. So, I mean, by what you said, he moved in with you fairly quickly, or you moved in with him, or...
Moved in with me that night. And he kept the room at the rooming house just for appearances, but he lived with me.
And was it because of that relationship that you sort of segued out of arts work and into other things?
No, not really. It was... I think it was probably a factor in my leaving the Indiana Arts Commission, but there were a whole lot of things going around. The board had become very factionalized during the time I was there, and a lot of infighting. The chairman that was the founding chairman of the commission left town, and someone else took over. And after that, without the chairman's support, it just ate me alive. And so it just became obvious that the only thing to do was resign. And so I did. But I think part of the animosity probably came from rumors and stories they'd heard about my sexuality. But I have no proof of that at all. So then, Steve had just started, was just starting graduate school, and so instead of finding another job or moving on, I took a job teaching part time at a Catholic girls' school, and then doing some consulting with the arts administration program at Sangamon State University in Springfield, Illinois. And then at the end of the year, when Steve got his master's degree, we moved to Ypsilanti, Michigan, because he got a teaching job at Eastern Michigan University. And the idea was that I was going to write. And 2 months passed, and no writing had happened. And I was totally strung out and felt useless and jealous of him because he had a job and all that kind of thing. So I finally took a job at a B. Dalton bookstore as receiving clerk for $2 an hour, and did that for 6 months, and then renewed a contact with the director of the Michigan Council for the Arts, Ray Scott, and he hired me as one of his assistants. And then I did that for a year, and then moved to Seattle and did professional fundraising for 6 months. And then I got the job as development director of Seattle Repertory Theater. And then I left there and went to teaching part-time in a community college. And while I was there, I started a two-year associate degree program in arts administration. And then I went to work for Boeing, and that's when I got out of the field completely.
Oh, okay. So there was, sounds like several years there where you were sort of in and out of jobs in the field before.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
I finally got out of it about 1983, I think.
Okay. And you said in your notes that one of the jobs you had in Seattle was a teaching job, and again, you probably don't have proof, but you have a fairly strong conviction that your sexuality was part of the reason why you didn't get a renewal contract or a full-time contract
there? A full-time contract, yeah. I started teaching business math at the community college, and eventually co-authored a business math textbook with a math anxiety approach that was published by Scott Forsman. And I had a PhD, which nobody else on the faculty had. And I, what they would do, we have a rather quaint rule in state of Washington where if you are part-time faculty at a college, if you teach a full load for 7 quarters, you're automatically tenured because it's proof that a position was available and you were filling it. So what they would do with me is have me teach a full load and sometimes an overload for like 6 quarters. Then they would drop me to 2 classes for a quarter, and then they'd pick me up again. And for quite a while, I was doing writing. I wrote the textbook, or co-authored the textbook, and also wrote a couple of romances and 10 detective novels, and a big beach blanket type book for Signet New American Library, and so I was identifying mainly as a writer, and so at first I didn't want a contract. And then after a few years, I realized that I was working as hard as the full-time people and doing as much work as they were, including serving on committees and so on. And I was making $12,000 in a good year. And so I thought, well, maybe it makes sense for me to have a contract. So I started asking for a contract, and I got all of these endless excuses. And I think pretty much it was because I was gay. That I think we had a president at the college at the time who was a closet case, and so he was very anti-gay, and so I'm pretty sure that's what was going on. And I finally, Steve went back to school to get a master's in occupational therapy, and so I needed to be the breadwinner for a while. So I went and had an interview with Boeing, and immediately picked up a job that was more than twice what I was making at the college.
Thank you for that. Maybe one more thing this time, and that's so when you would come back to your home. Well, let's ask it this way. Did you come back? Did you and Steve come back to your hometown as you were, as a couple?
Let me think. He came. What had happened was I was working for Michigan Council for the Arts at the time, and so was he. And I resigned and went back to Wisconsin to my folks, and he went to the Harvard Institute of Arts Administration for the summer, and then when he finished that, he resigned, and then he came to Wisconsin, and then we drove on to Seattle, but that was the one time that he.
Okay. Mike, there's a few more things I want to ask, but I want to wrap up for today.
Sure.
So I want to make sure there's either anything in your notes or anything on your mind, you know, particularly about your time here on campus or your early years in Wisconsin that you want to make sure you get on the record.
Actually, no, there isn't. You've done a nice job of getting me to talk.
Okay.
There isn't anything. I think that I may think of something after I hang up, which is usual.
Right.
But there's nothing right now. No.
Okay. I guess I would say on the record here, if you do think of something, just, you know, jot it down, because there is some sort of, again, present day things I want to ask you about in a shorter follow up interview. So
absolutely.
Mike, and then I want to just chat for a second after I turn this off, but I want to do the official close here. So this concludes the a follow up or a first interview, however you want to look at it, with Mike Warlam. Mike, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.